So, Leah, question for you. Which version of Oprah do you like the most? Is it Oprah 1.0? Is it Oprah 2.0? Is it Oprah 3.0?
Okay. I don't have a straightforward answer to this. I love Oprah 1.0 just because I love the big hair. I love the colored contacts. I love the like bright jewel tones. I just like the audacity. The theme song that I remember is the do-do-do-do-do. So like the original 1986 and then later the 1989 theme song. With that being said, I think the Oprah that I understand to be a powerhouse is Oprah 2.0.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
She is different from anything we have ever seen before.
Duh. Oprah 2.0 is my favorite, I have to say. Because for me, that was the most transformative part of my life. I think growing up, high school, college, and graduate school, where I tuned in religiously. And some of the conversations that she had, some of the moments that stuck with me the most is that 2.0 Oprah. And because, you know, everything about her at that moment was so aspirational. I was trying to live my best life. I was trying to get my life together. I was trying to write it down and have a vision. So if Oprah said it, then I was doing it, you know? The groupie. Hello, and welcome to You Get a Podcast from Radiotopia, the unauthorized study of the Queen of Talk. I'm your host, Kelly Carter Jackson.
And I'm Leah Wright-Rigger.
And we're two academics talking about all things Oprah. And this is our first episode back after a long extended break.
Overextended.
But we've got some goodies. We've got 2 months of episodes lined up for you and a bunch of new topics that we're excited to cover. Some amazing guests on the way.
Now, Kelly, our longtime listeners will notice that we have a new name. But that also means we have all new ways for you to connect with us. So be sure to look up yougetapodcast.com. Follow us at You Get a Podcast on Instagram and Twitter, and of course, subscribe to our newsletter. That way you'll be able to listen to all of our previous episodes and listen to some new ones that we have on the way.
Yes, and Leah, you will also notice that we're doing a one-time fundraiser. Just during the 2 months of new episodes, we're asking for your help in whatever way you can. We really want to help get the show back on its feet. So you can visit yougetapodcast.com and chip in. But the single most important thing you can do, if you're listening to this, is tell people the show is back. Post on social media, share with your friends, share with your family members. Tell them there is a podcast out there called You Get a Podcast. Okay, let's get into it.
All right, let's do it.
So corny.
I'm Kristen Meinzer.
And I'm Jolenta Greenberg. We are here to tell you all about our new show, How to Be Fine.
In each episode of How to Be Fine, we weigh in on what's happening in the world of betterment, and we offer a bit of solicited advice to our listeners.
You can expect us to touch on topics like fitness scams and schemes, personality quizzes, and more.
We won't promise to make you the best version of yourself, but if all goes well, we'll help you feel a little closer to fine. Listen to How to Be Fine wherever you get your podcasts.
Okay, so for the first episode back, it's just Leah and me, no guests, and we really want to talk about something that we've touched on a lot last season, but we never really got to like dive deep on it. We want to talk about how Oprah became Oprah, the Queen of Talk. And you've heard us casually refer to Oprah 1.0 and Oprah 2.0 and her evolution. But today, we're going to break it all down. We're going to talk about the context in which she got her start and became a national talk show host.
That's right, Kelly, because when Oprah hit the scene in the 1980s, she wasn't alone. There were a lot of talk show hosts kind of like Oprah. First, there was Phil Donahue, who had been on the air since the late 1960s. Then came daytime talk. So we are talking about Sally Jesse Raphael in 1983, Geraldo Rivera in 1987, Montel Williams in 1991, Morton Downey Jr. in 1987, Jerry Springer also in 1991, Jenny Jones in 1991. I don't know what's going on in 1991, but something important is happening. Maury Povich much later. Then there's the Tyra Banks show, right? Rosie O'Donnell, Ricky Lake. I mean, wow. We have
a lot.
of men and women who brought guests on in front of a live studio audience during the day to talk about the big topic of the day, of the week, or of course, something sensational.
So we want to take you back to the 80s, to the 90s, to the era of tabloid TV. And we just want to give you sort of like, I don't know, a portrait of this era in which everyone was having outlandish guests on their show. Like some of the topics of these shows that came on in the 80s and the 90s are just wild. And for a while, Oprah was a part of that as well. Everyone sort of had, whether it was paternity tests or skinheads or like crazy things about who's sleeping with who, cheating boyfriends, cheating girlfriends.
Who's the daddy? Who's the mommy?
My gosh, you are the father.
Fist fights, literal physical fist fights.
Yes, Jerry. Like it became like a moment in which it's insatiable TV. Like at 2 p.m., 3 p.m., 4 p.m., people in the afternoon cannot get enough of these either fights that break out or these scandals. It is all the rage, all the gossip. You go to work, you meet up with your friends and you talk about, did you see what happened on Maury? Did you see what happened on Sally Jesse Raphael or Phil Donahue? And, you know, ratings were a big part of this circus, if you will, for a daytime show. Everyone was in a competition to get more and more outlandish and more controversial. And it sort of led to a cesspool when you think about the content of daytime talk. I mean, did you watch these shows, Leah? Were you like a fan of anyone outside of Oprah?
Absolutely. I mean, so here's the go-to, right? If you're sick and you have to stay home from school, right? This is back in the day, late 80s, early 90s. So we still had sick days occasionally. You'd get some ginger ale, some saltines, plop your butt on the couch. First, you'd watch the soap operas, and then you would watch the trash TV. And it was like a rare treat.
So we should say that by the time Oprah gets onto the scene, when she starts her show, she's a newbie, but in a lot of ways, she's modeling off herself of the original OG, which is Phil Donahue. Phil Donahue had been on the TV since like 67 with his talk show. And he really set sort of the template and the standard for understanding like daytime talk and these sort of like interactions between the host and a crowd and a topic, or the host and the audience and a topic. And Phil Donahue has a range of discussions, and Oprah really picks up on this model and starts to do similar things as well.
I want to talk about like how different Phil Donahue is, but also how he revolutionizes the daytime television format, in particular the one topic format. So by the early 1980s, Phil Donahue is invested, at least, so he has the kind of national platform where he can take issues that he cares about, like these big national issues, and have a discussion about them on his stage. And he's not doing it in a way that is designed to provoke, right, physical fights. Like, they're not thinking about that. Things do get heated, but he is having conversations about race, about class, about abortion. Mm-hmm. He has Minister Farrakhan from the Nation of Islam on.
Yeah, Louis Farrakhan,
right?
Yeah.
Multiple times. He has Donald Trump, Spike Lee, right? All of these very big names, and they are coming on and they are talking about the issues of the day from different perspectives.
Mm-hmm.
And Donahue is really trying to do an interactive kind of community discussion where he has these experts, or in some cases, practitioners, right? Like a racist practitioner. But then he is getting the audience involved. They are asking questions. And so it's really supposed to be a serious conversation or dialogue on a national daytime, right, chat format. So when Oprah comes out in 1986, there's already a formula. Mm-hmm. And she's been doing this in Chicago to some extent. And I think it's interesting that Donahue also premieres in the Midwest, in Ohio.
Yeah.
But she takes that and she perfects it. You know, without Phil Donahue, there is no Oprah Winfrey. I think what ends up happening is that Oprah Winfrey revolutionizes what and refines what Phil Donahue has brought to daytime talk.
Mm-hmm.
She is doing it in a way that, you know, even though we all know Sally Jesse, the red hair, the big glasses,
yeah,
even though we all know that, like, Geraldo Rivera is bringing his investigative journalism skills, and at one point he goes into Al Capone's safe, and it's like a real buildup, and everybody in the country is watching it, and there's nothing inside. But... Right.
It's a lot of journalists. It's a lot of journalists that become hosts that sort of take their investigative skills or their interviewing skills to this larger platform of, you know, interacting with an audience, having sort of a panel discussion. But, you know, it in some ways becomes, I think, difficult when the field becomes saturated with every year or every other year there's a new host that's coming into the fray. You have to maintain audience, right? You have to maintain your ratings. And so the desire to become more outlandish or more scandalous or, you know, have something on that people can't, you know, wait to talk about the next day. Oh my gosh, did you see? That momentum really picks up in the late 80s, early 90s, to the point where you get to the mid 90s, I should say. And TV is wild. And that trash TV that you had mentioned before is becoming the new standard for how these talk shows operate.
There are people who are openly proud skinheads on television. There are, you know, people in Klan robes on television. Even though it's about knowledge building, there is a certain level of spectacle and exploitation that is designed to drive ratings because people want to tune in. And Oprah herself is guilty of this. You know, she constantly talks about producers, 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 what the producers want, the ratings. We have to think about how does this affect the ratings. So she talks in a more recent interview, 2009 cover story with People magazine, that one of the defining moments of her life is where she's having one of these episodes where they plan on having skinheads on the show, and the producers are going wild and they're saying, like, think about the ratings, Oprah. And she's like, oh my God, I feel sick to my stomach.
What I realized is I don't have to feel that. I don't have to put myself through that ever again. I made a decision that I would no longer allow the platform that I had, the Oprah Winfrey Show, the television audience platform, to be misused by people who were carrying any form of negative energy that could create more negative energy in the world. And that shift came in the moment that those skinheads walked out of the audience.
You know, we talk about trash TV, and I think we have to talk about, like, where does that word come from? And it's actually 1988, it's Newsweek, and it's in response to Geraldo Rivera having, like, skinheads on, and, right, like, it ends in a huge fight where Geraldo Rivera ends up with a broken nose. And Newsweek writes about it and is like, this is trash TV.
At that point, I was actively, I've always been a brawler, street person. So I had an attitude and almost a knowledge that push was going to come to shove, that something was going to happen. Because I remember I wore my combat boots.
On that particular program.
On that particular program. I wore my combat boots and I specifically told the guards, don't interrupt the fight unless I'm losing. And it was what it was. I'll always live with it. It's like I got my nose broken in a brawl with the skinheads.
When you're watching this, you know it's trash. You know it's exploitation. But you also know that it is drama. It is, to some extent, we later learned that a lot of this is scripted. But at that moment, it feels like real life.
Authentic,
and as we know, right, real life, 9 times out of 10, is stranger than fiction. So you got your soap operas with the drama, right?
You got your stories.
You got your stories. And then you have your reality stuff, right? Like, then you have the origins of trashy reality TV. And it was golden. My go-to, Jerry Springer. Right? Jerry Springer. Jerry, right? Like chant, Jerry, chant, chant.
Yes.
I had a classmate whose mother would tape Jerry Springer every day, like old VHS style, pop it in, and she would just
tape
the episodes. So when my parents would send me over to her house after school, like because they couldn't pick me up, she would sit down and she would let us watch it. And we just were like into it. It was like watching wrestling.
Yeah.
Because you knew somebody was going to throw a chair or, you know, Steve, the security guy, who ends up getting his own trash TV show.
Steve Wilkos gets his own show. But shows would give him birth to other shows.
Steve is going to show up on that stage and RIP. Jerry Springer recently passed away. And I see him in my, you know, childhood nostalgia as the innovator in trashy, exploitative talk shows.
Does he tell you he wants to be with you and leave her?
Yes.
All right, well, here he is. Here's Ramon.
Hey, everyone. Jody Avirgan here. I'm one of the producers of the show, and we've been away for a while, but we are so excited to be coming back with brand new episodes, a new season of the show under a new name, You Get a Podcast. Make sure you go to yougetapodcast.com to find out all the latest information. And on our website, we're running a one-time fundraiser over the next couple months during our new season. We're asking for your financial help, however you can, to help get the show back on its feet under its new name. You can give $5, you can give $50, I won't stop you, you can give as much as you want. But if you give $86 or more, we've got a special treat for you. Now, why 86? Well, 1986 is the year that Oprah started her show. So for everyone who gives $86 or more, we're going to do a special event with Kelly and Leah and the producers of the show. But look, whatever you can chip in, we really, really appreciate your support. This is a completely self-produced show. Your support will go directly to making new episodes. We've made it super easy for you. It's tax deductible. It takes 2 seconds. You can do it right on our website, yougetapodcast.com. Once again, yougetapodcast.com, and thank you. All right, here's Kelly and Leah.
Probably the pinnacle of all of these scandals, even more than sort of like the chair throwing and fist fights, is in 1995 when Jenny Jones, who another popular daytime talk show host, has on guests who are revealing sort of their secret longtime crushes. And one of her guests reveals that he has had this longtime crush with another man and sort of puts this man on blast by professing his love for him. And the man who he is professing his love to is so outraged by the fact that this gay man would, you know, claim his love for him, that he takes it to a whole nother level and he murders the man who professes his love to him. And this becomes a huge, huge scandal. Also, this becomes a huge court case in which the producers of the Jenny Jones show are found negligent. And, you know, the family of this man who was murdered was awarded $25 million. Listen, that's a lot of money now. That's certainly a lot of money back in the 90s. And this moment freaks everyone out in the talk show world, because it now means that, like, we can be held accountable for a lot of these shenanigans that are being put up on TV. And it's really before this moment that Oprah says, hey, listen, I'm not going down this route. Like, this happens, the murder happens in 95. In 89, Oprah's like, not liking what I'm seeing, and says, I'm starting my pivot, my shift. You know, when they go low, we go high. This is her moment of going high, essentially. And you start to see different conversations coming out of Oprah than what is happening in the rest of the field. And that pivot is really what starts to shift her into what we call Oprah 2.0. And she sort of takes the high road while everyone is still down in the trenches of trash TV.
Right. So we don't have any evidence that Oprah Winfrey cared anything about the Jenny Jones murder, the subsequent trial, the lawsuits, the acquittals, all of that stuff. She never comments on it. It doesn't appear to be part of her orbit. At the same time, We know that Oprah cared about the Jenny Jones murder trial payout acquittal. Everyone cared about it. Everyone, particularly since the first ruling against the Jenny Jones show says you are on the hook for what happens on your show, and now you got to pay. Now, the acquittal overturns that in part because the court rules that people cannot be responsible for murder that happens on their show, like unanticipated murder as a consequence of their show. So daytime talk kind of lucks out in that respect. But we know, particularly given the brands that these talk shows operate, that they absolutely would have been watching this like a hawk.
Yeah, and nobody's trying to catch a case.
Exactly. It's also true that this is the exact same time that Oprah is evolving. She's evolving her set. She's evolving her color scheme. She's evolving the music on the show. She tries out three different, right, peaceful, zen-like theme songs that are about empowerment and you go.
I think I'm gonna run on.
Right. Right. There's the one with Patti LaBelle where Oprah sings.
Yes.
Also the one where, like, it's the jazz version of I'm Every Woman, right? So there are lots of different versions of the Oprah Winfrey theme song that correlate with her changing. Mm-hmm. And so she makes this pivot in a number of ways. One, she stops going into the audience. The audience is now distant. Mm-hmm. She is the expert. She is offering you a masterclass and a chance to learn at her feet. Literally. Mm. She starts dressing different, right? It's far more sophisticated, softer colors. This is going to sound really crass, but she looks richer. She looks, right?
She is richer.
I mean, she is richer. But we see a decline in, like, the colored contacts, the big hair, the big shoulder pads. We see a quite literally refined and slimmed down Oprah Winfrey. She's rocking
and more
name
brands,
right?
Yeah, high end designers,
right? All these designers, and then like. I think also the color palette of the show, including the set, that iconic set that is now in, you know,
the Blacksonian, the Smithsonian. It's in a museum now. Her sofa set is in a museum.
It's an artifact. And I think it becomes an artifact by like 1993 when she trades up for like two gold seats. And then later for that like beige white couch, she stops moving into the audience. She says, I'm going to talk about body. I'm going to talk about health. I'm going to talk about wellness. I'm going to talk about spirituality. I am done with this trash phase of my life. And I am a new person. I have emerged as a different person. So there are all these aesthetic markers. And then she mixes it up, I think, with different kinds of topics. So while she's not, again, broadcasting like an abortion on television, she's still doing stuff that we might perceive as a little trashy, right? She is doing a wagon of fat. She is like, you know, quite literally pulling out a representation of the body fat that she has lost. People tune in for that. They want to see that. Yeah.
So she's doing like a warning sign show or, my gosh, one of the most powerful shows when she talked about like child molestation and she put out like images of FBI pictures of people that were known sort of sexual offenders. And a couple of people actually got caught. Like people were like, that's my neighbor. You know, like she was doing things that felt edgy for sure, but also had like a tinge of progressiveness about it that people would, it was almost as though people were trying to get more information and she was trying to be like, did you know, give you that kind of edge.
And just a quick story. I just recently read this really wonderful book by Patricia Turner called I Heard It Through the Grapevine. And it's about like rumor and conspiracy in Black communities. This is me putting my academic hat on. But one of the things that she points out is that like by 1989, Oprah is so popular that there is a prevalent rumor in Black communities that is repeated by not just like ordinary everyday people in you know, in these communities. But like Spike Lee is going around repeating it. And that's that Oprah Winfrey had Liz Claiborne on her show and that Liz Claiborne was like, my clothes are not made for black people. And Oprah Winfrey was like, I can't have a racist on my show. Get off. And Oprah took a stand. And the Oprah Winfrey people were like, that didn't happen. That has like never, ever happened. Like there's not even like a secret show where that happened. Right? But Spike Lee is still like, that happened. Right? And black people are still like, that happened. But she has attained this like level of preeminence that people are creating myths around her. And so when she pivots in 1989, right, and says, I'm not doing this anymore. I'm not doing the tabloid. I'm not doing the trash. Like, I'm rethinking the entire Oprah brand. I think she has enough clout that it not only sustains her, but it propels her to the front of the pack.
Mm-hmm, for sure. What I also think is wild about this moment is, you know, we said Jenny Jones happens in 1995. In 1995, there is a New York Times article that is talking about sort of this tabloid TV. And it says, quote, apologists for the more salacious talk shows like to say that Miss Winfrey's ratings slipped after she declared she would take the high road in the subject matter. They say viewers switched away from Oprah in their desire to see more sexual escapades, violence, and drug abuse. But Oprah has been the number one talk show for 10 straight years. So in November of 1995, her show had an 8.4 ratings, where Jenny Jones was second with 4.9. Ooh. So it's not even close, right? It's not even close.
So and, here's Oprah Winfrey out here being like, oh, look at my fabulousness.
I mean, this is when so many things happen in the 90s for Oprah. You get the most famous or maybe infamous interview with Michael Jackson. She gives that in 1993. You start to see her engaging with more celebrities that come on her show. People want to hear from all of, you know, the big people who are in Hollywood, the latest film that comes out. It's in 2000 that she starts her magazine. So that's when you get like, I'm not just a talk show host. I now have a magazine. You know, in 2003, she becomes an official billionaire, the first black woman billionaire. You get the Angel Network. You get the book club. Like, there's so much about her that is expanding.
Her favorite things.
Her favorite things
which
come
out. Which are also my favorite things. It's the gold standard.
Yes, yes. She's so much more than a talk show host.
Right.
So much
she establishes
more.
Herself as a tastemaker, as a gatekeeper, and I think someone who doesn't have her finger on the culture, she is the culture. And that is, I think, powerful. Now, does that mean that Oprah is not still engaging in exploitation? I don't think so. I just don't think that it has the trashy aesthetic of nearly every other show that's on television. And it's also remarkable to watch that even after the explosion of trashy daytime talk shows, Oprah actually inspires, I think, a different kind of daytime talk show, like the launch of something like the Rosie O'Donnell Show in 1996. The Rosie O'Donnell Show, which runs for 6 years, is absolutely not trashy tabloid TV. Right? Mm-hmm. It's more about like feel good, fun, women, empowerment.
And giveaways.
Right?
Giveaways is all of the
funny. Rosie O'Donnell is a comedian.
Yeah.
And I think that is
And you go to these shows to get stuff. Do you know what I mean? And I feel like, you know, if there was a musical artist on, you got their CD, you know, underneath your seat. There's also something I think that's interesting that like, while Jerry Springer sort of gives birth or rise to Steve Wilkos, when you think about Oprah and her like spinoff children, you know, she launches, you know, Dr. Phil and Bob Green and Susie Orman and Nate Berkus and Rachel Ray and, you know, all of these people that come on her show either get their own shows or get their own sort of fame and stardom. But it's done in a way where it's cloaked in positivity. It's cloaked in maybe a much more progressive or forward thinking. This is how you live your best life moment. Like, people are using these shows as aspiration, right?
Yes.
As something that they want to improve themselves, as opposed to watching trash TV and feeling superior to the people who are on those shows. You know, I could look at Jerry Springer or Montel Williams and be like, I'm not as bad as them. But you watch Oprah and you're like, oh, snap, I need to be like them. And that, I think, is the difference for the people who come on.
Right. And so, you know, I think it's complex. She, as part of Oprah 2.0, she shifts her focus, but also solidifies herself as a talk show host for white middle class audiences. They love her, and her show is really tailored around those things that I think appeal to that kind of audience. But Kelly, you're right. Because it is aspirational, even as her audience is, right, and her focus is directed at a white middle class audience, Oprah 2.0 still has that aspirational element that allows her to have an audience that is also poor and working class. So it's like, it's really nuanced in this moment.
To me, like, I think it's interesting that sort of whiteness and capitalism really work hand in hand with the show. When you think about the fact that early 1.0 Oprah, she's very much like the Black woman host, and her audience is diverse, and Black women are loving her. Black women still love her. Yes. But by the time you get to the 2000s, Black women are a little like, they're a little upset. You know, they love Oprah. But if they had a bone to pick, it would be that she no longer felt like their champion, or no longer felt like she was speaking to them. I will say that. When she has, you know, certain conversations on her show, it does feel like it's geared more toward women who can stay at home, women who are not just middle class, but maybe upper middle class. When you see her sitting on her show and, you know, you're looking at the bottom of her heels because it's probably a red bottom or a Christian Louboutin, there are certain fashion elements that were just, you know, in some ways so unattainable, maybe aspirational, but practically unattainable to a lot of the people who are watching her show. But also the people that she promotes, when we think about your Bob Green, your Nate Berkish, your Dr. Phil, your doctors, these are not, you know, Black experts. Aside from Gail, there's not too many people in Oprah's life that reflect elements of the Black experience that feel universal. And I think people resented her for that, resented the fact that she wasn't putting on a lot of Black people.
I think she understands this, right? I know she's aware of this, even if she doesn't speak on it. One, because she's a quiet investor in a number of Black educational, right, aspirational things. And we had an entire show on this, right? Her quiet investment in something like A Better Chance. She actually has a Better Chance Scholars on her show during the Oprah 2.0 period.
Sending men to Morehouse, sending men HBCUs. To Morehouse,
yeah. Funding their education. But I think she tries to get at it in really distinct ways that allow her to, you know, give a head nod to her Blackness while also not alienating that white middle class audience. And, you know, one of the ways she does it is by highlighting somebody like Toni Morrison. You know, she's has Toni Morrison on the show several times. So it's like, how do I make Blackness palatable to my white audiences? And how do I show them that it's fun, it's safe, it's rewarding, it's important. And there are a couple of moments where she's a lot rawer than that, particularly when she's talking about her own history, like her own sexual history, her assault history, growing up as a Black woman, when she meets her, you know, her sister, which we also did an episode on.
We did
an episode on that too, tune in.
Yeah, but I think all those episodes come later in the Oprah Winfrey Show. Like, I think by the time you get to the 2000s, certainly mid to late 2000s, she is the queen, bar none. There is no one left on the scene. The only one that probably comes close is Ellen DeGeneres. Right. And it's different because Ellen is a comedian, and, you know, she's having a different experience when you're in the audience with her. She's dancing, you know, she starts out the show dancing up and down the aisle. That's not something that Oprah would do. I think there's maybe an age demographic in, like, who's watching Oprah versus who's watching Ellen DeGeneres to some extent. But there's a different level of engagement that she has where she can be very choosy about who she has on her show. And the aspiration is, you know, like you were saying earlier, if Jerry Springer calls you and says, we want you on our show, it's like, no, you don't want to do that. But if Oprah calls and says, we want you on the show, your career has just been made. But I do think that, you know, there was a moment in which you really could not be Oprah. Right. And if you wanted to be Oprah, you had to say at the start of the show, I'm trying to be Oprah, just right. like Tyra Banks does.
The daytime chat format is also dying too, right? So while we, you know, while we have these really giant like network talk shows that are stables like the Today Show, Good Morning America, you know, CBS This Morning, other shows like The Chew, gone, mm-hmm. right? Yeah. The Real, gone. Right? The View is still the gold standard, but the talk is hanging in there, but it's hanging in by a thread. This used to be a landscape that was littered mm-hmm. with, you know, like with
dozens,
with talk,
dozens.
Right? Dozens of talk shows. You turned on the TV. Who is it? It's Carney Wilson.
Oh, yes.
Wilson Phillips. Yes. She has her own talk show during this period.
Rolanda. Anybody remember Rolanda? Rolanda. She was a black woman that also had a show as well. There were some randos that
everybody had a show. Everybody had a show in the 90s, right?
But what I think is incredible is that by the time you get to the 2000s, it's really just Oprah. It's ultimately mm-hmm. when she takes that stance in 1989 and decides I'm not going down this road anymore and backpedals up a whole nother stream. That's sort of the end of it to some extent. Like her taking the high road really leads all these other shows into oblivion. I mean, like, yeah, okay, Jerry Springer has 30 seasons, which is incredible when you think about that. But it's like, but who's watching? Do you know what I mean? It comes on at like 1 a.m. or whatever, or it's like, it's not prime time anymore. It's certainly not something people are discussing. It's actually something that might be considered a little publicly shameful to say that you watch Jerry Springer, certainly in its 23rd season or whatever. You weren't saying that. And yeah, I think Oprah comes out on top.
It's undeniable that Oprah comes out on top. But one thing that Oprah also does is that we've had shows on this in our previous season, is that she gives platforms to people that I would call trashy. I think most people would agree that they are trashy. So the king of daytime talk for a very long time, Dr. Phil, there's a shift in his show where he goes from this kind of self-help, you know, spiritual yeah. stuff to employing the production staff of the Jerry Springer Show.
Wow.
So is that trash TV coming full circle?
I mean, you know, Dr. Phil was on the air for mm-hmm. a very, very long time.
His number ratings, one talk show. Number
his
one
ratings
talk show.
And Dr. Oz's ratings were number one and number two, especially after Oprah is mm-hmm. no longer on the scene. What I think is interesting, though, too, is that you start to see the subtle ways on Oprah's show in which some of what we talk about as like deviant behavior or controversial ideas, that line gets blurred, softened, becomes a little bit more seductive. There's some interviews I just remember about Oprah doing, like the Jenny McCarthy and vaccines. Like there is, you know, when she pushed the secret and, you know, sort of these name it and claim it ideas. There is a lot of those, I think, frameworks that get cloaked in acceptability, but they're really, really problematic when you start to peel back the layers. I mean, Dr. Oz, we've talked about this before. Dr. Oz comes on, legitimate cardiologist. But then you start to hear some of the things that he says on the show and you're like, wait a second.
Quite literally selling snake oil.
Right? Yes. Like, yes.
Selling snake oil.
There are some ways in which she takes herself out of that picture. And then there are other ways in which you see her perpetually dipping her toe in the cesspool that is problematic ideas, problematic conversations, problematic people.
Right. Right. It's complex. The only people who are allowed to do trash TV during the daytime are people that Oprah has endorsed. But what happens is I think as daytime TV, trash TV dies off, it migrates. It shifts into reality TV.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So reality TV emerges right around like 2001, 2003, but it's always been relegated to the evening, right? prime time. So we get Survivor, the Great Race, which is like really gentle, but then we get The Simple Life.
Right? We get The Real World.
We get Rich Girls.
The Bachelor, right? The Bachelorette.
The Bachelor, The Bachelorette. We get Flavor of Love.
Oh my right? God. We get The Real Housewives of Pick a City.
Right? Pick a City. Right?
And literally.
It's also true that because it is, I think, late night, it is easier for people to talk about, right? And to say, I'm a fan of this show, right? It's because it's salacious, but it's relegated to the nighttime.
It's easier for people to consume because in the 90s, as women are going back to work more in larger and larger numbers, the ability for people to be at home at 3 o'clock, at 4 o'clock to consume this kind of TV is not there. And so everyone's typically home in the evenings to be able to watch TV. Right. I will also say that and this is later, but like TiVo, DVR, the ability to record TV to watch it later is also something that is a big part of that as well, choosing when you watch. I know that when I watched most of Oprah, it was at 4 p.m. But when I was in grad school, she came on again at 12:45. She came on again about 1 a.m. and I almost always, because I was just a night owl, watched her again at 1 a.m. So, but the ability to be able to choose when you watch, I think, is a huge part of that.
But I will say she reigns supreme. There is no competition. Even Ellen DeGeneres isn't able to pull off the queen of talk, despite her many years, nearly two decades on television, right? Ellen DeGeneres ends her show in scandal and disappointment. And so I think, Oprah Winfrey is the undeniable queen of talk.
So hopefully that gives you a sense of how Oprah has shifted over the years. And if you hear us refer to Oprah 1.0 and 2.0 and even 3.0, you'll know what we're talking about. We did a lot of that in the first season. We did a lot of episodes on some of the moments we mentioned in this episode. So please go check those out. And this coming season, we'll be talking about Oprah episodes from all over the map. We're doing the infamous Forsyth, Georgia show. Remember that, Leo? We're doing Oprah's relationship with hip-hop.
Also yikes. Also yikes.
Oprah's relationship with Gail. And their
amazing.
Iconic, yes, their road trip together. Their
amazing,
road trip from
iconic.
California to New York.
Aspirational. Everything you want in a friendship.
Yes, and a sisterhood, a real sisterhood. So that's what's coming up in our new set of episodes. We cannot wait. We hope that you join us. Tell a friend. Make sure you subscribe to the show. Share the show. Visit the website. Thanks for listening. Class dismissed.
Peace out.
That's the bell. Class dismissed.
Back to the books. Back to the stacks.
You Get a Podcast is a proud member of Radiotopia from PRX, a network of independent, listener-supported, artist-owned podcasts. Special thanks to Audrey and Yuri and everyone at Radiotopia. Remember, sign up for our newsletter, send us an email, follow us on Twitter and Instagram. You can find out more and help support the show on our website at yougetapodcast.com. You Get a Podcast is a production of Roulette Productions. Our executive producer is Jody Avergan. Our producer is Nina Ernest. Our beautiful artwork is by Jonathan Conda. I'm Kelly Carter Jackson.
And I'm Leah Wright Rigger.
See you next time.
Radiotopia.